My name's Nick Deolius. This is the Far Middle Podcast. You're listening to episode number 35. As we do with every episode, we're going to dedicate number 35 to a professional sports athlete of note. And we're going to go with Phil Niekro for episode 35's dedication. Of course, Phil Niekro was a knuckleballer extraordinaire when it came to pitching. But what I really liked about Niekro, and the reason why I picked him predominantly, wasn't because of necessarily what he did on the playing field. Instead, it was because of his background. He was the son of a coal miner. I've got a place near and dear in my heart for coal miners. Grew up in eastern Ohio, not far from where I grew up in the Pittsburgh area in western Pennsylvania. So he's a northern Appalachian guy. And he was a childhood buddy, and I'm not sure if they went to high school or not. I'm guessing they did. But he was a buddy of John Havlicek, the Celtic and basketball great. And I've got a funny story about John Havlicek. He was an individual I had a chance to meet. This is probably maybe 20 years ago at an event out west in the middle of winter in Arizona. So it was an event in a nice location, basically during a tough time of year in the eastern United States. So it was a well-attended event. They had a number of different sports celebrity athletes there, basically playing in a pro-am type of an event for golf. I'm not a big golfer, but obviously I'm a sports fan. And we went to a welcoming event, and I got there a little early, and we're standing by some pool at this resort, and this gentleman comes up to me, and tall individual, and we get to talking, and he says, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Pittsburgh." And he says, "Oh, I grew up in eastern Ohio, and what do you do?" And talked about how I worked in the energy space, and he got into talking about how he did an internship when he was at college at a company, and the company that he interned with is the company that I worked for and that I continue to work for. So that individual ended up being John Havlicek, and it was just odd to meet somebody like him and find out just through happenstance that he had worked and spent some time at the very same company that I basically have worked at my entire career. So that's my John Havlicek story. Great guy, wonderful, wonderful person to meet. But back to Phil Niekro, his friend growing up, his dad taught him how to throw the knuckleball. And when you looked at Phil Niekro playing, at least when I did, he didn't look like your typical professional athlete in the prime of his career. He looked more like a dad playing baseball, sort of an older guy out there playing with his gray hair and just sort of his physique and his approach. Almost like a beer league guy, but he was anything but that when he was on the mound because he was pretty effective. Gold Glover, a number of years, I want to say maybe five years he won a Gold Glove. So, you know, he was no stranger to fielding when he was on the mound. And of course, 300 plus wins, which is a huge accomplishment. I want to say Phil Niekro is the last guy that was able to win and lose 20 or more games in a season. I think he was 21 and 20 one year, which is amazing. Considering that theme that we brought up before on how starting pitchers these days, their workload is almost a joke compared to what it used to be. Think about that, Phil Niekro being 21 and 20 and how many innings he had to pitch during that season. He did throw a no-hitter. Unfortunately, we lost Phil Niekro about a year ago, so not that long ago. And some different sort of, illustrative ways of viewing Niekro. I mean, somebody said that watching him pitch was like watching Mario Andretti park a car. I thought that was a pretty good one. And Pete Rose, he went on record in the past talking about how he would get his swing down. It would take him weeks to perfect his swing through the start of a season or midseason. And then he would come up against Phil Niekro, and Phil Niekro would be able to screw up his swing that he worked weeks to perfect in just a couple handful of pitches. So Phil Niekro, our dedication for episode 35, and proof positive that sometimes the unconventional and the different is exactly the way to make a mark in a chosen field. Now let's start connecting dots, and we're going to sort of hit on a couple of themes when it comes to pandemic and managing it, everything that's going on in the world today with respect to it. It's just been so consuming in all of our lives, right? So let's go from the twisting and turning of knuckleballs with Phil Niekro to the twisting and turning of a different type. You know, here it's in public policy dealing with how we're managing COVID, how we're managing pandemic. I get the sense, I'm sure you do too, that what used to be, if you look at a certain tactic, and you can pick a handful of these tactics, but what used to be talked about or labeled as unenlightened or anti-science, obscene or crazy, right, depending on on how extreme and the timing and who was sort of messaging it. So tactics that used to be labeled as those types of things. Today, lo and behold, when it comes to managing pandemic, those same tactics are now being sort of labeled as astute and smart and following the science. So, you know, what are some of these examples that I'm noticing, and I'm sure you are, that are being completely, I don't know if you call them flip-flopped or reversed, but they're just completely up in the air, constantly changing to a place where what was once unenlightened is now smart, and what was once anti-science is now following the science. Well, one example for sure, the shutdowns themselves, right? We went from demanding, instituting from a government perspective, these really draconian shutdowns to manage pandemic, to stop the spread, you know, all those sort of hashtags and catchphrases that were out there. But now we're looking at the way we manage COVID and pandemic and all the variants. Now we're avoiding shutdowns. And this is one instance where I'm agreeing where the current thoughts are. I'd focus much more following things like the Great Barrington Declaration recommendations of, you know, beefing up and heightening the protections of the most vulnerable, the elderly, the at-risk, the pre-existing conditions, and avoiding the shutdowns. But nevertheless, this complete reversal on the ability or the efficacy, so to speak, of shutdowns has sort of been surprising to see. You also see this in sort of a related point, but just sporting events, professional collegiate sporting events. You know, we went from no fans at these events, which was sort of weird for a season or so, depending on the sport, when you're trying to watch it on TV, to now we've got packed houses, or at least in some cases, we've got packed houses. I think attendance generally is off in a lot of professional sports. You don't see as many sellouts, but you do see tens of thousands of people, right, convened in close proximity, many instances indoor arena type, indoor stadium type venues. And that's just become, again, the norm. But you look at what is going on with respect to infection rate and stopping the spread. It's just funny to see in some ways how much the sort of elite and the government, depending on local, state, federal, have changed their views on attendance of sporting events. And it's been an interesting evolution to watch. Travel bans were another one. I remember the first travel ban when it came to China. A different administration in place at the time and sort of the heat that that drew. And I'm sure there were optics tied to that travel ban because of where the ban was targeting with respect to China. But I'm sure there was also some logic behind it with respect to the pandemic. And then we evolved to these sort of travel bans with respect to South Africa, where a travel ban was on recently, then removed recently. And again, you could make arguments on both sides of the fence as to whether or not it made sense or not. I still think, I'm not sure exactly, maybe you guys are, what the current status is with Canada. I don't know if we can, as Americans, can travel into Canada or not. I know for a long time we weren't able to, but that's always been sort of one that's lingered out there. And then you've got the issue with what's going on with the southern border and how that's being handled with respect to travel to and from across the border versus how you're managing pandemic. And all of these, right, from the China situation way back when all this started under a completely different administration to what's going on today with the current administration. Again, that changing and the evolution and what some might call the flip-flopping, I just get the sense there's a lot more optics driving that versus and sort of public perception versus, you know, following the science. That's just a feel that I've got. The other example is, and this has been a really interesting one for me, right? If you're interested in the Constitution and checks and balances and states' rights, the administrative state, you know, we went from ripping authority from states and local governments and basically putting a federal government in charge of what we're doing in terms of managing pandemic. And I don't even want to start to get going on what it did to individual rights. It just completely tore those away. But now you sort of had recently our own president almost giving up, throwing his hands up in the air and saying that this isn't going to be a solution. It's going to be coming from the federal government and needs to be dealt with by the states. Now, there was some backtracking with respect to that. Once again, gives you the sense that it's not necessarily pandemic management and science that's driving these positions. It's just more politics or optics or something else. And then you saw even this type of behavior and sort of the twisty, turny knuckleballing of policy when it came to the CDC, of all things, and how they are altering the data with how many infections are due to the new variant that's out there. So I thought, you know, data were static, certainly coming from the CDC, but that's subject now to wild swings and changes on a look back basis. Sort of feels like China when they would continually put out data on economic growth or port capacity or all these other things, and you never put much stock in it because you knew some of that data to a certain point was skewed or manufactured to present a certain picture, and you always see these wild adjustments. Well, now we're seeing that with our own CDC when it comes to infection rate on COVID and its respective variants, which is a bit troubling. Vaccines, you know, they went from being the savior in getting us out of pandemic, away from COVID, to now clearly vaccines are not at least the entire answer or savior in and of themselves. By the way, I'm a big believer in vaccines, so I'm still going to continue to get boosters as they get rolled out. But it's just interesting to see how the view from a vaccine perspective has changed from the answer, the definitive answer, and the end to this problem to something that's maybe still important, still needed, but you know it's not going to completely address the issue. And then you saw this too with guidelines on quarantining. I mean, remember when it was 2 weeks via contact tracing, which created all kind of havoc. Now it went to 10 days, and now I think it's, 5 days via the CDC guidelines under certain situations. I think that, again, is a product not necessarily a pandemic and the science of pandemic. I think it's more a reality of what some of these types of quarantining periods are doing to workforce and to workforce availability, to inflation, to supply chain, and the bottlenecks from it. I think people figured out that this type of an approach is just going to completely kill economic activity, which has even bigger long-term consequences for millions and millions of Americans above and beyond what the new variant of COVID will have. And then, of course, there's the vaccine mandates themselves, right? We went from no mandates to the push for mandates, back to no mandates to now, I guess, some mandates, I guess would be the best way to put it. So what's going on here, right? You see all this volatility, all the twists and turns. What was the phrase from Lola by the Kinks? It's a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world. That seems to be the case with managing pandemic. And I think what's happened, it's called reality, for lack of a better term. Bureaucrats and government and media who are being caught in this unforgiving world where at one point, right, you've been in charge for a while now, so it's not like you can just sit there and snipe. It's someone else that's in charge. Sniping is easy. But now it's going to be much tougher, much more challenging to actually lead and be judged on sort of quantifiable, measurable, visible types of results. And the failures or the struggles that we've encountered, I mean, they've been obvious, and in some instances, they've been monumental. And flip-flopping, whether it's based on polls or other problems, issues or metrics right beyond infection rate or death rate, that type of thing, the science of the pandemic, you're seeing that flip-flopping, and you definitely get the sense that this is becoming more and more about polls and politics and perhaps the next election, which is a bit troubling if you believe that there's a chance that we're setting these rules and these guidelines with the view of them trying to help win the next election instead of, you know, with the view of trying to save as many lives as possible. Now, would a politician or a bureaucrat do that? Certainly they wouldn't, right? I'm not so sure. So COVID, I guess it's gone from what was at one point a political opportunity for those looking to gain power to now one, it's a bit of a political liability for those same people that are looking to hold on to power. And many of those that are sitting there in the corridors of power, now they own it for better or for worse. We need to be rooting for them because there are lives at stake of ourselves, our neighbors, our family. And I think the current leader's management of pandemic in this nation is now getting as shaky and fluttery as a Negro knuckleball. No one knows where it's going next. I bet within a week we'll see yet something different coming out from the quote-unquote experts or elite scientific class. Now, despite all these swings and twists and turns of our so-called leaders managing pandemic, or maybe it's a better way to state it, pandemic managing the leaders, we do have, through all this, two stalwart consistencies that are never changing. One is mask optics, and the second thing is Fauci infallibility, which means, that's right, it's time for another installment of Mask Mania on the Far Middle Podcast. And I've been meaning to get to this one for a while because it is a bit insane on many fronts. This was the issue recently on a commercial flight. You had an older gentleman and a lady on the flight that got into a altercation. I guess from what I could tell, the older gentleman was eating, but not wearing a mask. The lady was returning from the restroom, wants to get past the drink cart that's blocking her access to her seat. She gets into an argument with the attendant who asked her to wait until the cart passed by her. She makes a poor comment that was in bad taste. The guy who was sitting there without his mask on eating calls her on it. Those two get into an argument. Obscenities start flying. Before you know it, the gentleman is punched and slapped, scratched, and spit on. The guy wasn't wearing a mask when he was screaming. The lady yelling at him, her mask was sort of around her face, but below her mouth. It was like down around her neck, so it wasn't doing anything effective. Ironic, I guess, on both parts. And just watching this, you know, OMG. I saw, too, afterward, that the lady was an ex-Oakland Raiders, or I guess now Las Vegas Raiders cheerleader. And I guess the outlaw culture mentality of the Raiders, it goes beyond the playing field with respect to behavior. But once again, you know, common respect, decorum, dealing with human beings and one another, you're seeing a wearing down of that everywhere you go these days. And that is troubling. I don't think it has as much to do with masks as it does with just the state of the American psyche. Now, in addition to having another installment of Mask Mania, and I have a feeling we're going to have more of those down the road, I don't think that's going anywhere anytime soon. We're going to be not struggling to find new content for that installment. We've also got an installment of Fauci Focus. So this goes back to Dr. Fauci. Is he a scientist? Sometimes he seems that way. Is he a politician? Sometimes he seems like he's that. And does he follow the science, or does he instead push the political science, or maybe a little bit of both, depending on the timing and the situation, or perhaps one more than the other? So recently, our Fauci focus for this episode is going to go on this recent development that I thought was quite interesting. You had a principal deputy director of the NIH, and also its chief ethics officer, basically, who told Congress that the NIH indeed funded gain-of-function research on COVID in bats at the now infamous Wuhan facility. Now, this did apparently go through this funding, right? Went through a third-party entity that NIH funded, and then that third-party entity funded the gain-of-function research work at Wuhan. So, you know, went from basically government NIH to a third-party entity, and then the dollars went from the third-party entity into this gain-of-function research. Now, this makes it sound like, if you listen to this testimony, from what I could tell, it sort of implies that the NIH was misled. They either, you know, they basically didn't know about this happening, and they didn't know about it because they were misled by this third-party entity, which would be a convenient, I guess, explanation of this if you're the NIH or the leadership of it. I'm not so sure if that's true or not. I can't really assess, but I thought it was sort of convenient that they were implying that that they were misled to a large extent with respect to that actually occurring. Why this ends up with being a Fauci focus moment is because of Dr. Fauci's prior statement. And that statement was pretty unequivocal. It said, quote, "The NIH has not ever and does not now fund gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology," end quote. Now, as a buddy of mine likes to say, that's now, quote, totally false. Okay, as my friend likes to say. So what happened here? Was it maybe government and NIH not paying attention and a bit of a sleep at the switch with respect to where its dollars were going and what third-party entities were doing with those dollars? Or were they aware of what's going on and now you're seeing a bit of a covering your bases and a bit of a cover-up to make sure that the blame doesn't fall back on you? I think obviously something of this magnitude and importance, it's critical to investigate it further. And to see, you know, what were the roles being played by U.S. tax dollars, by your money, to in some ways enable or help create the pandemic now that the entire world is dealing with. We'll see what comes out of this as time progresses. In this topical conversation on this episode of The Far Middle about, you know, COVID and pandemic, the management of it, got me thinking about longer-term damage that inept management of the pandemic has inflicted on specific or certain industries and sectors of the economy. And I want to talk about three in particular. And I picked these three because they have one thing in common. They are three things or services that I absolutely loved my entire life. I loved participating in them or consuming them. I was a dedicated consumer of them. But today, you know what? I sort of go out of my way to avoid them as much as possible. I basically have minimized these things in my life with respect to participation or consumption of them. And that should worry players or leaders in those three industries, because for certain, I am not alone. I know a lot of others out there feel the same way that I do. And that reversal is going to create a bit of a demand problem, to say the least. So the first industry I want to talk about is movie theaters. I've been a huge fan of, follower of film and cinema for all my life, basically. And I love going to the movies, but that's no longer the case. And there's really two big drivers to this. One, the advantages of going to the movies, they basically have disappeared. You know, going back a long time ago, one of the biggest advantages I can remember going to the movies, especially in the summer, was that it was air conditioned. You know, air conditioning was an exception when it came to homes. And when it got to the dead of summer and oppressive heat, right, one of the nice things about going to the movies was you got a break from the heat and you were entertained for a couple hours in the interim. That obviously is not an advantage that exists in any large form anymore. Another big reason you went to the movies is you couldn't see that film anywhere else, or at least for a really extended period of time, unless you went to the theater to view it. Now, when you look at streaming today, that's no longer the case, right? The time has been completely shrunk to where, in some instances, there is no time, or better yet, perhaps worse yet for the movie industry, the theater industry, you get some really quality in-demand content that are going direct to streaming. They're not even made for the movie theater, whether it's new Netflix series or movies or Amazon Prime or whatever the case might be. And then you always had this this audiovisual technological superior experience in the movie theater, right? The big screen and the sound system that you didn't have at home. But today, of course, with HD and with these TVs and these sound systems, I mean, not only can you match what's in the theater, you can basically beat it if you throw enough dollars or technology at it. And then on top of losing those advantages, the movie theater industry is now dealing with headwinds or disadvantages that didn't exist before. Much of that, again, coming from sort of the way we've been managing pandemic. So there's this issue, right? If you want to go to the movies, it depends on where you live, but you may have to consider your vaccination status, or you might have to actually proffer proof of, or, you know, provide some personal information to go see the movie. And ironically, and again, depends on where you live, in some places, you have to get more prepared and submit more information to go see a movie in a theater than you do to go vote, which is just a strange situation, but that's 2022 for you. It's a communal experience, right? And you're going to be exposed to a lot of angry people. We've talked about decorum and how humans are treating one another increasingly in worse situations and circumstances these days. And then you got this issue, not just in movie theaters, but across all sectors of the economy, particularly service areas of the economy like movies, theaters, where you don't know if you're going to have your staff and service available to the level that's going to make for a positive experience. So if people aren't working, you can't fill open positions or variants of pandemic or taking people out of work, that's going to manifest itself in a sort of bumpy experience when you're going to the theater and dealing with concessions or ticketing or the movie itself. So movies, I think, they're in a strange place with respect to theaters and releases. Why is it a strange place? Well, typically, you see new technology that's first picked up, embraced by the younger generation, and then the older technology is still continued to be used. It's still continuing to be embraced by the older demographics. But here, I think you're seeing sort of the flip-flop of that. Here, the old technology of going to the movie theater, it's being dropped and jettisoned by the older demographic. And its only hope right now is to try to draw the younger generation, the younger customer base, who are using it more as an opportunity or an excuse to socially interact, to hang out with friends, that type of thing. So it's just an odd sort of way that you see the demographics breaking down on who's still interested and yearning for the movie theater experience and who isn't. And you also see, you know these headwinds, you see these headwinds being legitimate because the media in sort of the movie business and film business in the industry itself, they are trying like heck to hype new releases. And you're just seeing this push to get excitement, to get sort of a buzz going with new releases, but still they're flopping at the box office. And the most recent example I saw was West Side Story, the remake of the play in production by Spielberg. It got just, you know, rave reviews. You would have thought this thing is Citizen Kane or the second coming of Citizen Kane. But from a box office perspective, huge disappointment. Second industry that I want to talk about that is just fundamentally changing, at least with respect to how I view it, wanting to run to it not long ago and now trying to avoid it at all costs in 2022, is air travel, and specifically commercial air travel. First, it has become a massive time commitment when you look at the amount of time from when you're leaving your front door to the destination of whatever, you know, destination door, I'll call it, of wherever you're trying to get to. If you add up all that time from, you know, front door to airport parking lot, and then from airport parking lot through security to gate, you got to leave enough contingency time, right, to make sure you're there ahead of flight, what might happen with flight timing, and then all the reverse sort of unfolding of that development chain, that logistical chain to get to where you're trying to get to. It's a massive commitment of time these days, much larger, much, much larger than what it was back in the day. And then now on top of it, there's this huge risk. And the risk is the risk of the unknown. Are you going to have a flight delay? Are you going to experience a cancellation? And realizing that if you do have a flight delay and you got a connecting flight, or you are going to experience a cancellation, that's going to sort of snowball with respect to the impact it's going to have, because everything is just running on much thinner sort of safety margins and capacities when it comes to seats and flights, et cetera. So you're going to get even further backed up with your timing. We talked about people on flights, a lot of angry people out there. We talked about this, you know, the staff are just worked really thin, bare boned right now. They're stressed out as well. That puts them in a typically and oftentimes bad mood. You've got rising costs. So this could be for bag fees. This could be for picking your seat these days now has a fee tied to it. There's all kinds of these incremental costs that are being added to the flight experience itself. And then, you know, the other weird thing about this is a different type of uncertainty, right? I said the risk of the unknown with delays and cancellations, but then there's also this uncertainty with respect to travel bans and testing protocols for a pandemic, for COVID. Where you go, which state you go to, definitely if you're leaving the country, if you're going to, you know, the Caribbean island, or you're going to Europe, or you're going to Canada, everybody's got their own sort of Byzantine set of rules of testing protocols. And then you're thinking through, my goodness, what happens if I get to a destination and then I've got to get a test before I get on my return journey, and then I test positive? Well, now you're stuck there for whatever, 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever the rules are with that specific locale. That will definitely chill the interest in wanting to travel. And then you got mask mania, right? You're packed in like sardines on a flight. That's never a good experience, but now it's even worsened with respect to COVID and pandemic. Look, I will do whatever I can these days to avoid a commercial flight. I'll do video conferencing. I'll drive it. I will drive excessive distances to avoid a commercial flight, et cetera, because you feel as if you're in more control of your destiny and you're not going to be subjected to as many wild cards or unknowns that you will be flying. And that's a shame, because like the movie theater experience, I love to travel. And, you know, the flight experience was part of the overall journey that you sort of look forward to. But boy, not these days. And that is definitely going to be a quandary for the airline industry, in that what you need to do to make your business model work, if you think about it, if you're an airline, is you're going to make it work, to make the numbers work, you basically have to erode or destroy the customer experience. That's why you see all these new rules and fees and costs and everything else. You basically have to make it more miserable or painful to fly in order to survive as an airline these days. And that is a quandary that is going to be a pretty tough puzzle to break for the airline industry moving forward. And then the third and final industry, you know, consumer experience that I think has just been fundamentally altered in terms of how I view it, is going out to eat at a restaurant. I love food. That's no secret. Always enjoy going to restaurants. Could have been trying out the new one. Could have been, you know, going to a favorite spot. Basically, being able to engage in an experience that you wouldn't be able to get at your own home in your own kitchen. But today, you know, that is not the case. I go out much, much less than I used to. Why? Well, staffing once again becomes an issue when there's not an appropriate level of staffing because of, you know, work rules, or because of job participation rate, or because of, pandemic, variants running amok, that's going to alter the experience when someone goes to dine in a restaurant. Reduce seating. A lot of restaurants, depending on where they're located and the rules of those states or cities or municipalities where they're located, they have different seating requirements that basically have reduced the density of seating because of pandemic. Well, that reduces the number of available tables, which means it's tougher, frankly, to get into a restaurant, the ones that are still functioning and running. And obviously, a subset of those being like the particularly good ones, the availability has just been drastically, significantly reduced. Then you've also got this issue that we talked about on a couple episodes prior of the far middle, the scale back menus because of supply chain issues, because of inflation. So sort of the combination of being able to get the quality ingredients for a broader menu coupled with the increased cost of it. And then you couple on top of that, right, the staffing reductions that restaurants are dealing with. It's no surprise that now you see drastically scaled back menus, which means the types of things that you can order and specifically things that you normally wouldn't be able to prepare in your own kitchen, those have been reduced in many instances and you're left with less choice, which is going to basically deter to a certain extent the experience. Masks, again, are an issue. Vaccination or proof of vaccination status, depending on where the restaurant is located. Once again, you see this weird situation where it's tougher. It takes more rigor. You have to disclose more information, personal data to eat in a restaurant, let's say in New York City, than you do to vote in New York City. Just a strange world that we're in 2022. Who would have thought? And then another thing with restaurants that is, I think, a factor that's a growing factor, particularly for restaurants that are located in our larger cities, which are many, right, is this subject of safety, public safety and crime. There's a lot of people who are increasingly worried about going out at night, right, to eat at a certain restaurant in large American cities with the issue of public safety. And I think that is a real issue. It's hard to quantify, right? It's hard to gauge. It's not something you can just measure on a hourly basis. But I do think it is having an effect with reducing the demand for potential diners that are looking to head out to a restaurant, and specifically at night and in maybe larger, more populated areas where crime issues might be more challenging. Then last but not least, right, if there wasn't enough for restaurants to deal with, and I guess this is sort of a good thing, bad thing, the sort of food delivery services, Uber Eats and DoorDash and all those other ones that you've got, that allows you as a consumer in some ways, it's sort of like streaming for video. It allows you to order your favorite dish from your favorite restaurant to have it delivered to your doorstep where you can enjoy it in the comfort of your home versus heading out. Now, again, that's a yin and a yang for the restaurant owner because in some ways it's increasing your business if you're offering that service, but in other ways, it's diminishing your in-location diners and volume, which has its own implications. I think that'll wrap things up for episode 35 of the Far Middle Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this one. Again, we stayed mostly on pandemic COVID-related themes, but it's been so prevalent. It's everywhere you look these days. It's hard not to talk about those from time to time. I want to conclude by celebrating an icon who created many of our institutions that drove our free market economy to dizzying heights and our quality of life to unimaginable levels. And sadly, I guess a lot of those institutions are now going through their own challenges and headwinds. Some of them might even be broken as well. But nevertheless, we should be celebrating the birthday this month. I think it's January 11th is his birthday, of Alexander Hamilton. Self-made individual, came from abject poverty and made himself into something iconic, as I said, war hero. During the Revolutionary War, founded Bank of New York, founded the federal banking system, first Secretary of the Treasury in this nation's history, founder of the U.S. Mint, the subject, yes, of a great Broadway play. I've seen it a number of times with the kids, but I'd also give his biography a read when you get a chance. I think it's Ron Chernow that wrote it. And let's not change that $10 bill, okay? Let's keep Hamilton on a $10 bill. There's plenty of opportunities across our other currencies to honor noteworthy Americans in our history and our sort of journey. But let's keep Hamilton on the $10 bill. He's just too damn important. I'll talk to you guys soon. You can follow me on Twitter in the interim at Nick Deolius. Check out nickdeolius.com, the website, for new items and materials posted on it. And I'll see you in another week with episode 36.